طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر. تسكله ماسا لون وطن، تسكله ماسا لون وطن، نفقا لعودة اللاجئين وفراش المنفى، نفقا لعودة اللاجئين وفراش المنفى من شتى.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Donald Trump has the capacity to mete out mercy killing to all the empty formulas, to let the air out of the peace process balloon, and to finally kill off the walking dead known as the two-state solution. So writes journalist Gideon Levy, columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He continues, "If only the president-elect of the United States will keep his word, we must now pray for the health and well-being of Donald Trump and hope he does not go back on his big promises to Israel. After he moves the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, preferably to the eastern part of the unified capital, we must hope that his election will also bring about a change in U.S. policy toward the settlement enterprise." I write these words without a trace of irony. If Trump gathers up the courage to make such a change, then he will contribute more than any of his predecessors, more enlightened than he, to reaching an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. Trump has the capacity to mete out a mercy killing to all the empty formulas, to let the air out of the peace process balloon, to serve one last drink, to disperse the grotesque masked ball, and to finally kill off the walking dead known as the two-state solution. His statement, reported in the Wall Street Journal, that he hoped to make the ultimate deal between Israel and the Palestinians, must be attributed to his ignorance. Such a deal no longer has any chance. It does not even have one serious partner. But Trump can shake up the situation. That is what he was elected to do. Such a shock is essential. Before the election, he declared that the settlements were not an obstacle to peace and that he would not stand in their way. The time has come for a president to speak that way too. The policy of his predecessor, all his predecessors, is what has allowed some 800,000 settlers in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, a critical mass which has led to the point of no return. Trump's predecessors said they opposed the settlements. What did they do to stop the construction? Begged, asked, sometimes reprimanded, once or twice even harshly. Occasionally they muttered, "Freeze," but every settler hut in the occupied territories belongs to them. They funded it, did not lift a finger to prevent its construction. They were the friends of the enterprise, the presidents of the settlers. Trump is supposed to put an end to this farce, the end of hypocrisy, even with the self-righteousness. Onward with the settlements. Trump promised, and Trump may carry out his promise. The time has come to slacken the straw reins. In any case, another 100,000 or 200,000 settlers will not change anything. Letting go of the reins will tear away the mask. The settlers will build. The law legalizing settlements built on private Palestinian land will pass. Even without the law, no one has considered punishing them for their crimes, and the tricks of Amona and its like will end. Area C will be annexed to Israel, and additional areas in its wake. The legal situation will finally catch up to the situation on the ground, and the situation on the ground has been one of annexation for a long time already, but now only without the disguise. No one will be able to deny the reality any longer. The Green Line is dead. The two-state solution will not arise. For 50 years already, a single state with apartheid in its east has existed. If Trump keeps his word and legalizes the settlements, the declarations about wanting two states, which no Israeli government has meant, much less endeavored to implement, will die. Trump will rip off the mask, and Israel will be exposed to the naked truth. We have a single state with two peoples, one with full rights, the other with no rights, with a military dictatorship of half a century. In the world, it is accepted to call such a regime apartheid. Thanks to Trump, it will be officially declared as such. It is possible that the Western governments will continue to support the existence of an apartheid nation in the 21st century, even after reality blows up in their face. It is possible that most Israelis will continue to live in peace with their consciences in their apartheid state. They became accustomed to it a long time ago. But there is also a chance that ripping away the cloak by the President of the United States will outrage governments and public opinion. The only solution that will remain will be changing the form of government in the country from apartheid, which grants undemocratic privileges to one people compared to another, to an egalitarian democracy of all its residents. In other words, one man, one vote. That is the twist of fate. It is impossible that the implementation of this exalted and just slogan, which was born in South Africa, will actually go down in the books in the name of Donald J. Trump, the man who it is doubtful whether he has even heard of it, and certainly would not agree to it in its time. That was an article by journalist Gideon Levy, columnist in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Our featured speaker this morning is a Gazan independent journalist, Mohammed Omer, who spoke at the Middle East Forum at the Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard University. He paints a portrait of the reality of Gaza in this presentation, which had PowerPoint illustrations obviously unavailable to our radio audience, but was really driven by Omar's compelling narrative. Harvard professor Sarah Roy introduces Mohammed Omer.
I'm very, very pleased to welcome Dr. Mohammed Omer to the Middle East Forum and to the CMES. Dr. Omer, who recently received his PhD in Media and Communications from Erasmus University in Rotterdam, is an internationally known journalist who who comes to us directly from Gaza. His reporting and writing over the last decade in particular have garnered him several prestigious awards, including the Lenin Cultural Freedom Award, the Asietsky Prize, which is also known as the Norwegian Pen, the 2008 Press Freedom Prize given by the Swedish branch of Reporters Without Borders, and the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism awarded by the British Academy of Television Arts. His reporting has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, the National Zeitung in Germany, Fagbladet in Norway, Al Jazeera, The New Statesman, and Agence France-Presse, among many other international publications. Currently a visiting researcher here at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, Dr. Omer is also the author of 5 books, both published and forthcoming, on Gaza, on media in the Arab world, and on the Oslo Accords. He has served as a consultant and or advisor to the Luxembourg Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Norwegian Representative Office, and the Norwegian Development Agency and Terre des Hommes, among many others. He has lectured at Columbia University School of Journalism at New York University and has been a featured and or keynote speaker before the United States Congress, the United Nations, and the Greek, Swedish, Dutch, and British parliaments. So please join me in welcoming.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you, guys, for coming. I'm actually, whenever I start to speak, I have a little difficulty to... I ask the people of Gaza, what the story you want Americans to know? And I got like hundreds of these answers already, and I'm already bombarded by messages which the people of Gaza wanted to convey. But what I'll try to do in this next 45 minutes is basically to take all of us here into the Gaza Strip. So what we'll try to do is to go on a trip. But before we start that trip, there are a few facts that I would like you to remember about Gaza. Well, talking about Palestine, just going historically, this is what used to be Palestine before 46, and then as you see in the map, the green side is Palestinian side, and then 47, and then right after the 67 war, and 2000. This is 2000 and not 2016. 2016, we are talking about buffer zone and Israeli F-16s and missiles that limits the areas where Palestinian fishermen and farmers can go and fish. Gaza is a very small place. I mean, as you can tell from LA, how small it is, or New York. It's a very tiny land. We are talking about 25 miles long, so we're talking about a place where you can drive basically from one end to the other within 1 hour. Gaza has been controlled under the British and the Egyptian and the Israelis. I have a great admiration for the work that the Quakers have been doing. In fact, the Quakers started to educate all the United Nations, especially UNRWA volunteers who came to the Gaza Strip to help the refugees. And we are talking about 80% of the Gaza population that rely on aid provided by the United Nations. We are talking about 2 million Gazans who are living in the Gaza Strip. 69% of them are under the age of 18, and 1.2 million suffer. I used to use the term post-traumatic stress disorder until a psychiatrist in Seattle corrected me and said, this is not post, really. This is continuous when we are talking about those children who continue to have these nightmares. We're talking about an open prison, basically. Gaza is surrounded. This is the Egyptian side here, where I'm living. I used to live in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. This used to be houses, full of houses, as exactly this side. This wall, is which Israel created, and by the way, the same company that built this wall is actually now offering the United States to build another wall between the U.S. and Mexico. They destroyed thousands of these houses. Now, these houses are not existing anymore. So Sisi did his job in that part of the world, and the Israelis did their job in that part. and the area is basically
empty.
What we will be talking about is the medical care, the dependency, the school, the education value, and everything else in between. So, we'll start a trip. Usually, when you want to go to the Gaza Strip, you may think, well, I'm American, I can't get into the Gaza Strip. Try again. That's not possible. You can go to the Gaza Strip, you may think, well, I'm going to get into the Gaza Strip and, well, we'll make it possible through my contacts. Well, if you're not a journalist and you have to get an Israeli government press office card or an international humanitarian worker working either for UN or international NGO, you won't be able to get to the Gaza Strip. There are two ways to get into the Gaza Strip. One is via the north, Israel, or the south, Egypt. Now, I must say the way to the south is extremely dangerous because you will drive through Bayt al-Maqdis. You know, Bayt al-Maqdis is a branch of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. And you will be driving for at least 26 hours from Cairo to Al-Arish over via Sinai and to Rafah crossing. And if you're lucky, you will be able to get it. But more likely, most people don't make it into the Gaza Strip via Egypt, so the other option would be actually going via Rafah crossing. Now, entering the Rafah crossing, Rafah has been mostly closed for many, many months. They just opened it for a few days, and when I say they, I mean the Egyptian authorities. So we have entered into the Gaza Strip after a big miracle, and I'm not sure if that's going to happen in reality, but let's assume we are in Gaza. The first encounter that we face is in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, and that is Rafah, the tunnels. You would be very surprised to see the number of workers who are working in the tunnels. Now, it's not as much as it used to be in the past, because these tunnels were dug in the first place to allow medical supplies and food and everything, even car parts. Even whole cars were allowed to get into the Gaza Strip via these tunnels. Tunnels were used as a lifeline for the Gaza population until the Egyptian troops flooded these tunnels with sewage water and seawater. So, and yesterday, four Palestinians, young men, they died inside these tunnels. And we are talking about at least 400, mostly people under the age of 25, who died in these tunnels because they flood them or they collapse, either by F-16s or electric wire, or water. So, tunnels is a business that it has been running. Nowadays, we are talking about only 4 to 5 tunnels out of 950 tunnels that used to operate across the borderline with Gaza. Egypt has made it impossible for people to come in and out. I remember very well during the time of Morsi, which was for Gaza the best timing, by the way. A Gaza friend of mine, he used to go all the way and he would be calling his girlfriend on the other side and say, make a cup of tea for me. And then he would be walking. In 5 minutes, he's already on the other side of the world. Now, this is not possible. This is impossible now because you get thousands of people who are trying to get outside, including cancer patients. I dealt with a case of cancer patient at Rafah crossing where somebody was trying to get outside of Rafah and she couldn't because she was asked to pay $6,000 as a bribe to the Egyptian officer on duty. She did not have that money. And I ran to talk to this guy and I said, hey, she has cancer. She's going to die. He said, tell her to die in Gaza, not in Egypt. The second encounter about the strawberries in Gaza, and it's only today, this morning, that Palestinians were allowed after many years to export the strawberries to the Gaza Strip. It's only this morning we are talking about that Palestinians were able to export the strawberries outside of the Gaza Strip. Unfortunately, this business has not been flourishing because even though Gaza makes the most beautiful strawberries, delicious, that's in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, and also carnation flowers, but the Israelis would not allow these materials to be exported outside of the Gaza Strip, and that has crushed the economy. We are talking about people who were crushed completely because of their inability to continue the export of materials and and the strawberry and carnation flowers. We are talking about people who had to feed the carnation flowers to animals instead of sending them to Europe. These flowers are supposed to be going to Europe, for instance. And most of those workers who are working in this business, they simply lost business just because they wouldn't be allowed to export their materials outside of the Gaza Strip. But we get a lot of bananas from the Gaza Strip, that we became suddenly the Republican of bananas in Gaza. And I got really surprised by how much bananas that comes from Israel into the Gaza Strip. So I was wondering, why is that? I mean, bananas is too much that comes into the Gaza Strip. There is shortages of medical supplies, shortages of electricity, shortages of fuel, but so much bananas all of a sudden. So I ran into a Palestinian authority official. And by the way, they are the best ones to tell you the real story of the Israelis. Because at the end, you know, they go to the same place at the end of their duty, then he will tell you what is going on. So this farm, banana farm, is actually belonging to an Israeli commander who, in exchange of selling his bananas to Gaza, he gives VIP privileges and permits to the workers and to the merchants who sell the bananas in the Gaza Strip. The third encounter is the bakery in the Gaza Strip. Behind this woman, there are at least 200 men and women who are waiting to get bread. Anybody can guess why there is no bread in the Gaza Strip? Why there is shortage of bread? Flour is one reason, yeah?
No fuel.
No fuel, no electricity. We're talking about big crisis in the Gaza Strip. Whenever you hear about a war or escalation, then you get thousands of people who run to these places. You're talking about a population that are not really... There's no way to think beyond the daily needs. The thing that you think of is, how are we going to get water? How are we going to flush the toilet when there is no water? How are we going to have fuel to run our generators? The same situation with electricity. We are talking about 12 to 18 hours of power blackout every single day in the Gaza Strip as a result of the blockade. And the same thing with gas cylinders. Gas cylinders is some crisis which are huge in the Gaza Strip. You could be waiting here for days or weeks or even months, if you're not lucky, to get the gas cylinder. How else are you going to cook? You can't make food when you don't have a gas cylinder. That's the only option to make food, really. We don't have woods in Gaza. People in Gaza, they just go and wait in line for all these different gas stations. And it all depends on the moods of these Israeli soldiers when they want to open the crossing and when not to open the crossings. For instance, if you happen to have a family of 7 or 8 and you want to feed them, this is not going to last for more than a week. So this is a constant pressure on people to keep their daily life and routine and demands met. The fourth encounter is collecting clean water and fuel. You will be very surprised that 5, 6, 7 days you don't have running water inside your house. Well, there is no running water. You can't even, as I said, flush a toilet in the Gaza Strip because you don't have that water. When you don't have electricity, you don't have water. The same thing with lines of fuel. You get thousands of people across all the cities who are in line waiting to get some fuel. Why? Because the Israeli system is built in a way not to allow this fuel to go in larger quantities into the Gaza Strip. But also Palestinians don't want to get fuel into larger quantities. Because, you know, who would want to have large amount of fuel in the Gaza Strip when things could just break any moment? I mean, we heard about a lot of cases, including UN facilities, UNRWA facilities that were bombed and they had a fuel and they were burning for days. So everybody is trying to avoid this situation. The fifth encounter, which is very important, is the value of education. I met with this young man just 2 weeks after the war. He had lost his 2 legs and 1 arm. And he still insists that he wants to go and teach in Shijaiya, in Gaza City. I was really surprised to see this man and said, well, I mean, what motivates you? He said, life has to go on. We can't stop. The resilience is very high in Gaza, that nobody can beat, really. It's you get people who their home would be destroyed or bombed, and then the first thing they would be looking at is a school bag in order to go to schools. I have seen that a lot, especially in Shijaiya area. Kids who say, oh, there is 11 o'clock, get ready for school. House is bombed, there's nothing. Dig down, you have to dig out all these school materials and go to school. This is actually the everybody, you know, in Gaza, especially the elders, the only way for them to beat the Israeli occupation is through education. This is why you find the highest number of education. It's impossible to find a family who is not sending their kids to school. And 80% of the population send their kids to honor schools, that's you and run schools. So it's really something that people consider very holy to send their kids to schools and to continue their education. But the sixth encounter in Gaza about something building a business. I was very surprised to see a man in Gaza who's making all these beauty products. And he used to export these products into Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, Sudan, across everywhere in the Middle East, employing thousands of workers. But not now. Because Israel decided they don't want to allow the export of all these materials outside of the Gaza Strip for security reasons. That's the situation which we see. A man who could employ thousands of people, he can't. And this is just one of many successful businesses that make many things inside the Gaza Strip. And this is not new, really. His father started this business in 1963, so they could continue if the Israelis would allow them to export their materials and products outside into another market, not Israel, or the West Bank even. He said, if they open the West Bank, I will be able to hire thousands of people. We don't want to rely on anybody's economy. We just want to rely on our own economy as Palestinians. You know, I actually find it very strange that the coriander was on the banned list of the Israelis. Coriander is to make falafel, actually. And it was on the banned list. Shoelace, ketchup, tea and coffee, they have been for a long time on a ban list by the Israelis. And I was very surprised when I met with John Kerry and I said, thank you, Mr. John Kerry. It's only today my mom is able to cook macaroni. He said, are you making fun of us now? I said, I'm not. And then he looked and said, well, we are very happy that we convinced the Israelis that Gazans can't be firing rockets with macaroni. So macaroni was allowed to get into the Gaza Strip. Finally, the same thing with coriander. The coriander that used to come via the crossings is no longer allowed to come via the crossings. So people bring this new shape of falafel, which is not really tasting as nice because we use the powdered coriander in Gaza. The Gaza and the sea fishing trade is something which is struggling nowadays. We are talking about someone like this who has been for 30 years fishing in Gaza, and I can assure you one thing, he's fishing in an area of 6 nautical miles that is virtually fished out, because the moment he crossed the 6 nautical miles, he has two options. One, to be arrested or get shot. And hundreds of the fishermen, out of 4,000 fishermen in the Gaza Strip, have been either arrested or injured as a result. Because they could not really go beyond that. And the moment they tried to cross beyond these 6 nautical miles, then they would be injured. I remember again the days of mercy, Palestinians, we used to go all the way inside and avoid the Israelis and go beyond the Israelis through the Morsi or the Egyptian border line. So they would go to Egypt, and then from Egypt they would go all the way and come with a lot of variety of fish, which Gaza have known only in the 90s. The seventh encounter of something where I have great respect for the health workers in Gaza who continue to go through so much problems in order to do the job that they are doing. Children who rely on limbs, for example, in Gaza industry, you don't have fuel, you don't have medical supplies still. And you get ambulances that are smashed and ambulance crews that have been killed. I have seen a lot of my friends and colleagues in the field, including ambulance drivers and medical workers, who have been killed during the war because they were bombed by the F-16s, even though you can't really mistake that ambulance. That's an ambulance. You can see that this is an ambulance. The same situation of walking into this, the shelves of the Ministry of Health in Gaza. And I was very surprised, really, because there was a situation of a lady who wanted to have medical supplies and it's not available. And I insisted on the deputy minister that it is available and they favor some people over others. Now, he challenged me and he proved me to be wrong. We ran to the shelves and he said, okay, well, we don't want to allow journalists here, but okay, come. See what's inside here. You will be very surprised to see some of the medications that Israel allow into the Gaza Strip have only 2 weeks before they expire. And I was shocked. And he's not allowed to say that to the media. Because he said, you know, we want to rely on a good relationship with the Israelis. Because the moment we speak, then they say, oh, well, see, they are bad-mouthing us. We shouldn't be even cooperating with them. That's the situation of medical supplies in the Gaza Strip. The destruction of 2014 war, where I have been as a correspondent during the day and the night. During the day, I was working for Middle East Eye, Al Jazeera, and others, and during the night, reporting for Al Jazeera. The war, 51 days of agony, 51 days of darkness, 51 days of fear, 51 days of not knowing whether you are going to be awake next morning or not, 51 days of saying goodbye to your relatives and saying, okay, we are not sure if you're going to survive tomorrow or not, 51 days of the funerals, 51 days of hearing bad news about your relatives, about your brothers, about your sisters who have been injured and killed, or somebody who died, 51 days of neighbors next to you who one day you see them, they are alive, the next day they are not there. 51 days of going to hospitals and meeting with people, arms and legs and fingers that are scattered throughout the roads and the streets. 51 days of fear, which I have documented in my book here, Shell Shocked, which you can get online. 51 days in the Zanda area. You walk into this area and you find like there is a stench, human flesh that is burning somewhere underneath. And it's actually some people who were burned by hellfire rockets, which are produced in this country. And they're burned and nobody could pick them up or take them to the hospitals. We're talking about entire population of everything that got really destroyed inside the Zanna area, Shijaiya area, and Khuza'a. We're talking about an entire residential complex here that's been ruined. And this is when you get in, when you enter the Gaza Strip from the northern part of the Gaza, Beit Hanun. That's what you see. And that's Shijaiya. Shijaiya, everything is smashed. Like in one night, everything is gone. I remember also the 1st of August 2014, which was a Black Friday, over 200 Palestinians have been killed in 1 hour. Rafah, the southern part of the Gaza Strip, where 200 inhabitants are living, they don't have one single hospital. Not one single hospital. People had to take the bodies of their injured and killed and put them in refrigerators together with the ice cream and the vegetables because there are no ways to bury them immediately. It was not safe. You will see a lot of those families and people who would be going outside in the streets looking for their small children and sons. And I remember that lady who was coming to the hospital in Rafah and she said to me, did you see my son? I don't know who she is. I mean, she's giving me a description of a son who was wearing a short, a black short, and sandals, and he's only 7. So, well, okay, the only thing you can take here is to the mass vegetable refrigerator, where a lot of the bodies there. Believe it or not, she was given a body of a child. And she had to claim that this is a child is hers because her child, the body is not existing. It's only a shoe that is left and some fingers, and the rest of it is burnt. She was given a body of another child to bury as her own child. And this is happening constantly in Gaza. You get phone calls that your son is injured or killed, and then you go there and then there is no body. There's no physical body to touch. There's no physical body to take because it's burned. And those are like hundreds of cases that continue like that in Gaza. But also great respect for the churches in the Gaza Strip who opened the doors for the people during the war. Father Manuel Musallam said to me, "We struggle together, we starve together, and we will die together." The churches opened all the doors for the people in Gaza. Even the churches were bombed afterwards. And the priest was there bringing food and medical supplies and all materials that homeless families needed during the war. The human cost of the war is very high. This is not 2014, this is right after 2014. This is actually last year. I ran to this place where Israel says, and you know, we always get the news what Israel says. We don't get the news of what these people say. We always get the news of what Israel is telling us, what we need to believe. They say we hit the Hamas facility. I'm a journalist, so my job is to run to the place and investigate what is a Hamas facility there. The father, four children and wife, and only the father and one child survived, and the rest, they died in an airstrike. And that was not a Hamas facility, as he claimed. It was a very poor Bedouin family who simply could not afford to live anywhere but in the prefabricated houses, and a house where it leaks when it rains, and it's pretty cold and damning cold, where the people could not keep warm. The level of trauma that is left in the Gaza Strip by the people of Gaza is beyond comprehension. You find all these kids who arrive to the hospital without families. They just don't have anybody around them. They lost everybody. In the southern part of the Gaza Strip, Abu Jami'a family had lost 31 family members in one incident. 31. I went to Shija'iyah area, I went to Azanna area, and I found the whole family is just wiped out completely. Not one survival. But there could be also worse situation like this boy. The mom was killed, the father has been injured severely, and the child is left without a social system to protect the children. Nowadays, look at the social system, or look at the sponsorship or anything that supports these kids. No way. You can't. You know, there are many cases like that. Thousands of those are children that are left without parents, and they don't get any form of aid or support, not from the Palestinian Authority because of the Palestinian division. But animals are lucky in Gaza. Animals are very lucky in Gaza. The lion in Gaza suffered trauma. That's what the headline says. Then immediately you get a lot of these organizations in Europe, animal rights organizations, saying why the animals of Gaza are suffering. We have to do something for the animals. Well, they made it. Here they are in Gaza in order to rescue the animal, and that's a lion. So the whole Gaza Strip, 2 million people stood and watched an animal being taken outside, while thousands of patients who have cancer, they're still stuck and they can't leave. Well, a few days ago, they published a photo of the lion. He was taken only 3 weeks ago, and now he's all right. The last encounter of the Gaza is the Steadfast in Gaza Strip, which you can find everywhere. No matter where you are, regardless of the grim reality on the ground, but you find a lot of people who are willing to continue to survive and to celebrate and to live. You know, just people in the Shijaiya area, for instance, you find images like that quite a lot. And you find the children in the ruins of their demolished homes and the schools that are playing parkour. What I'm trying to do with this actually is to that we all here share the information about Gaza, because Gaza is certainly not anywhere in the international media with all what's happening in Syria and Yemen. And I hope that you can urge your elected officials to end up blockading Gaza. Blockading Gaza is illegal according to international law, according to the United Nations. It's illegal. It's only Israel that is enforcing the blockade in Gaza. And please join with what you learn. You can put on using the hashtag on Facebook and Twitter, Gaza Unlocked. And you can read more about Gaza. This is one of my books, and the next book, which is on the pleasures of living in Gaza. I mean, some people are surprised at the title, but I mean it. And I hope you can continue to support these families. You go to places like that in Shijaiya, and people are just looking for something to eat, and they dig deeper into the ruins of their demolished houses. I was very surprised to go to Shijaiya right after the war, and I met with this family of electrician who fixed something for me a few years, and he recognized me. And then his mom said, okay, she had nothing. Everything is just flattened. Everything is destroyed. And then she said, but wait, you are a guest in our town. Let me look for the tea bags underneath here. Well, she started to dig for the tea bags in order to make me tea in the ruins of her demolished house. You find a lot of these stories of resilience, and Gazans, you know, they need to live like everybody else. Egypt needs to open the border of crossings. The blockade must be lifted, and to allow the Palestinians to get in and outside. There are many ways for Palestinians to support themselves. Thank you.
That was a presentation given by Gazan journalist Mohammed Omer at the Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard University. Before we wrap it up this week, we want to recognize a victory in the growing BDS campaign to boycott Hewlett-Packard products. The Christian group Friends of Sabeel North America has initiated a campaign to promote the boycott of Hewlett-Packard products in individual churches. Several Protestant denominations have made a commitment to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, and now are trying to get individual churches within the denominations to join them. The Peace United Church of Christ in Santa Cruz, California, is the first to do so. The congregation voted to refrain from buying Hewlett-Packard HP products, including printers, computers, and ink cartridges, until HP companies cease to profit from Israel's violations of Palestinian human rights. Peace United Church of Christ joins the Presbyterian Church, Unitarian Universalists, United Church of Christ, Quaker Friends Fiduciary Corporation, and the Alliance of Baptists, which have all divested from HP companies at the denominational level. These organizations represent over 15,000 U.S. congregations and the potential for millions of dollars in buying power. Friends of Sabeel North America initiated the campaign HP Free Churches in coordination with the Global Week of Action Against HP that saw over 150 actions take place in dozens of countries across six continents. Many individual congregations are unaware that their denominations have divested from companies that profit off the Israeli occupations, or their purchases contradict their denomination's divestments. We aim to fix that, said Rochelle Gauss, Sabeel's national organizer. HP companies supply Israel with a biometric ID card system used to restrict Palestinians' freedom of movement, provide servers for Israeli prisons where Palestinian children and political prisoners are held and tortured is widespread, and manage the communication centers, information security, and user support of the Israeli Navy as it collectively punishes the civilian population of Gaza through blockade. Similar to the way Polaroid was boycotted for providing the technology for the apartheid South Africa's racist passbooks, Hewlett-Packard companies were selected for their integral role in Israel's notorious checkpoints and segregated ID system. After immense pressure, Polaroid ended its involvement with the South African regime in 1977. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.